Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to our Blog Talk Radio show, brought to you by the Columbia and Weill Cornell Center for Eating Disorders. My name is Barbara Smolik, and I've been your moderator for the past few sessions and will again today. We're broadcasting live from Washington Heights in New York City. This is officially Eating Disorder Awareness Week, but we've hosted a series this month in honor of bringing awareness to eating disorders. We're excited to have two experts with us today, Dr. Timothy Walsh, who is the director of the Division of Clinical Therapeutics at the New York State Psychiatric Institute and professor of psychiatry, and Dr. Joanna Steinglass, who's also from the Columbia Center for Eating Disorders and an assistant professor of psychiatry. Before we begin, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping tips. Anyone can join this talk by dialing 347-996-5875 or by going to blogtalkradio.com/Columbia Psychiatry NYSPI. I know it's a mouthful, but I think you've heard this before. If you do have a question for the speakers, press 1 to speak to our host at any time, or you can send us a question through Twitter by mentioning the handle @ColumbiaPsych. We will address the questions in the order in which they're received. If you do submit a question that we're unable to answer live, we'll do our best to follow up with you offline. And with that, Dr. Walsh and Dr. Steinglass, we're excited to have you with us today. Could you please just introduce yourselves, and we'd love to hear you talk about today's topic, which is research.
I'm Dr. Timothy Walsh. As you've heard, I am a professor of psychiatry, and I direct a large group of researchers here at Psychiatric Institute working on eating problems, but also on anxiety and mood problems.
I'm Dr. Joanna Steinglass, and I work in the Eating Disorders Group, focusing mostly on research in anorexia nervosa and also working with the researchers across the different problems related to eating.
Dr. Walsh, perhaps you can start off by giving us an overview of research in general or at the center.
Sure. No, it's not unreasonable that I go first since I've been here the longest. I actually arrived at this very hospitable, for someone like me, medical center almost 35 years ago, which is in itself a bit frightening. And what I have been allowed to do or encouraged to do is to think about the eating disorders. Why do people get these things? Why can they be sometimes hard to treat? And how can we improve our ability to treat them? And it's actually been fun and a real privilege to be able to be part of this show for what is apparently does seem to be more than a third of a century, which is anyway. So just to highlight a few things. This center has been involved in and often at the forefront of research efforts on eating disorders over these several decades. And so we've been able to participate in and contribute to some major advances. I mean, I think we're better than we used to be in recognizing what eating disorders are. We have become, and the world has become, quite familiar with anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa and most recently binge eating disorder, as well as other problems. We know a lot about what the problems are, how to define them, how to identify people with them, what problems travel with them, both psychologically and physically. And there's been some real progress in our ability to treat them. I would note both bulimia and binge eating disorder. There's good evidence that certain kinds of medications and certain kinds of psychological treatment are very helpful. Anorexia nervosa is the oldest, sort of the grandmother of all these disorders. There's been real progress in our ability to treat it, particularly in youngsters. But we remain often challenged to help people with anorexia nervosa. And that is among not the only, but among the things that we continue to think about and worry about and try to understand better is sort of the mysteries of anorexia nervosa, how it develops, and how once it's developed, it can persist for so long in such a challenging way. And I've been fortunate to, over these years that I've been here, collaborate with a number of impressive and smart young people, including the young lady sitting beside me, Joanna Steinglass, who much I think she won't mind being thanked for this. I don't think she'll object, who brought me willingly, but to an area of science, understanding of how the brain works, which I think is encompassed by the term cognitive neuroscience. And she's really led the way in terms of applying this to eating disorders in general, but very specifically anorexia nervosa. I don't know if you want to...
I would add that in the description of this clinic and the research that we do, that what drew me here a decade ago by now was the not just the commitment to understanding these problems, but a really strong commitment to helping patients with these problems, and that all of the research that we do through this clinic is really patient-centered research, where we focus on what we think are the problems that individuals are struggling with and try to understand what is behind that. So how can we understand these disorders, but also always at the same time, how can we help the people who collaborate with us in trying to understand these illnesses. And I think that's what led us into the new venture into cognitive neuroscience, was this idea that this may be the best new direction for trying to understand in a very relevant way what is going on for patients who are struggling.
Yeah, I mean, I think Joanna put her finger on it. My own view, strongly held, is that this kind of research endeavor isn't us doing research on, by any means, subjects or patients. It's a partnership. I mean, we're trying to help them understand their problems and to recover from them, and they're trying to help us understand things that we don't understand about why these problems occur and persist. So this isn't this. I think we need each other, and we try to approach it that way. Is that we do our absolute best to help people get better, and hope they do as best as they can to help us understand things better than we currently do. And it works. It's actually almost always a good and productive and rewarding partnership.
Dr. Walsh, you mentioned that there are some treatments that you know work for some types of eating disorders and others that you mentioned we still don't know about. Can you just summarize for us what have we learned in terms of what does work and where are we still heading in terms of needing a lot more work to figure out what we need to
sure.
do?
Sure. So the best example, not the only, but one of the better examples, because it really has occurred in the last quarter century, I think, is during that time that bulimia really became recognized and noticed as a significant problem for young people, the binge eating and purging. So it got noticed, it got picked up, and when it was first noticed and picked up, people didn't know what to think about it. It really seemed like, is this just anorexia nervosa in a different costume? But one of the things that's been good about this field, and we've contributed to it, but many of our colleagues around the world have as well, is it was characterized, people began to work with different treatment approaches, so at this point, we know that most people with bulimia can be treated as outpatients quite effectively, often or typically beginning with a form of psychological treatment called cognitive behavior therapy to help them rethink how they think about themselves and their eating, and to focus on making changes in their behavior. And this CBT, the initials for this thing, clearly works very well, very helpful for the majority of people with bulimia. And in parallel, in a complementary way, studies have established beyond a shadow of a doubt that folks with bulimia are also helped by certain kinds of medication, particularly antidepressants, and particularly fluoxetine, which is the generic name for Prozac. That remains the only FDA-approved medication for an eating disorder. And very good work done 20 or more years ago established that it's a helpful intervention.
And helpful for the eating disorder. I mean, you're
right.
Characterizing the medicine as an antidepressant because that's what they get called, but it's not working particularly by helping with the depression. It's actually directly working on the bulimia, which was a useful piece that came out of that study as well.
Yeah. Joanna's pointing one of the mysteries. Well, how is it working? If it's not working just on the depression, well, how's that working? And that's one of those unanswered mysteries. But the good news is that in the course of research work over the last 25 years, effective treatments were developed and brought to market and brought to the availability of clinicians. So that I think people with bulimia are in much better shape in terms of getting their problem treated than they were 25 years ago. So that's been a real, I think, rewarding success story of what happens when people across the world, and that this is certainly a collaborative effort among a number of research centers, focus their attention on a problem, and you can see good results. So that's been a real success story, I think, for the eating disorders world. Binge eating disorder, I think, has been identified, as binge eating without the purging. And methods similar to the ones effective in bulimia are also very useful for the treatment of binge eating disorder. I think there's more to be learned about binge eating disorder and its treatment, but I think that we do know. We know how to recognize this problem. We know some of the things that are helpful to people with it. And that, too, is something that has happened in the last quarter century. And it's a real merit badge, I think, for the field. Anorexia, as Joanna and I have already hinted, I think anorexia nervosa remains one of the singular challenges for us. It's a disorder with which we are intimately familiar. I mean, we see a lot of folks with it. We treat a lot of folks with it. And we can see how they struggle with it. What's my view of what's happened in the last 25 years, one of the real advances led by people at now at Stanford and Chicago, is the articulation of a way to involve parents in the treatment of kids with anorexia nervosa, and the convincing evidence that the majority of these kids can be effectively treated, period.
I would back up a little bit even before that family treatment, that what became clear from work in the 60s, even before my time here a little bit, was that behavioral change is needed for patients with anorexia nervosa, and that we can actually help people do that by setting up a structure that helps somebody who's in the middle of struggling, somebody who's really consumed by an illness that takes over so much of their thinking. If you can set up a framework for them, they can follow that structure in a way that actually helps refeed and therefore helps their brain calm down and also helps them make some changes in eating and move towards healthy eating and healthy weight. And then, but those structures were always restrictive environments, like an inpatient unit or a residential program or some sort of a program that takes a lot of a person's time and a lot of their autonomy away and things like that. So those are effective. We know those work, but they have their limitations for people who maybe are out in the world, like kids and adolescents,
mm-hmm.
who go to school, so that the Maudsley, the family-based therapy treatment, figured out how to help kids get that kind of structure without having to leave home by teaching parents and empowering parents to provide that structure.
I think one of the things that what you just described accurately underlines is philosophically and pragmatically, to treat folks with eating disorders, you have to tackle at least two related problems. One is the behavior. I think our field has come to the recognition that it's a mistake to assume that the behavior will take care of itself, will normalize, without any specific attention, mm-hmm. if you do something else right. If you treat a mood problem or you treat an irrational way of thinking about shape and weight, those things may be very useful to do and important. But at the same time, we think it's critical, and I think the world that we travel in professionally understands that it's critical to also address the behavior. Because mm-hmm. often these behaviors take on a life of their own. That's a major focus of some of our current work.
I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit about some of the current research that is building on what you just mentioned.
Yeah, I think that there's a line of work that we recently completed that touches on a lot of the pieces of this. The important piece is the collaboration. We started by doing some work to try to understand what eating specifically was like for patients with anorexia nervosa. And patients were, on our inpatient unit, were willing to participate in having a meal in our research setting. And when we had this kind of, we call it a laboratory, but it's just a room where patients came and had a lunch with us. And in the process of having that lunch, we were able to really see what was happening, what they were struggling with in the course of a meal in a way that maybe we hadn't observed quite so clearly through the course of all the treatment on the unit. And what we saw was how much fear and anxiety came up in the setting of studying eating behavior, which led to thinking about, well, maybe there's a way we need to target this eating behavior that would take into account the fear around eating. And we know a lot about how to target fear and how to treat fear and anxiety from the anxiety disorders world. So it led to working with patients to sort of tweak the kind of cognitive behavior therapy that's used for anxiety disorders and apply it more specifically to anorexia nervosa. And we developed an exposure and response prevention treatment for anorexia nervosa that really was aiming at eating and a way to use what we had learned about eating behavior, turn it into a treatment, and then study on our inpatient unit whether that treatment is useful. And it was. It seemed patients certainly felt like the feedback we got from the patients we worked with was that it was on the right track, targeting something important. And the research results suggested that we could help people change behavior, but boy, was it hard. And that we aren't quite done in trying to figure out what the best tools are for changing eating behavior in anorexia nervosa, but at least we are building on the model that focusing on what's happening in the meal and in the room around eating is a really important place for treatment providers to focus their energy.
And, you know, a place that we're taking that as well, I mean, to continue that line of research or a line of research that relates to what Joanna just described, it also made it clear to us, crystallized for us, how hard it is oftentimes, for people to change their behavior, even when they want to. The spirit is willing, but it's hard to, for them to get themselves to do the things they know they should do. And so that led us to initiate a collaboration with some of the smart folks in the Department of Psychology at Columbia downtown, who spend their time trying to understand how the brain, the organ of the mind, how the brain articulates choices and learns behavior, and how we make our behavior change, and what makes that easier, what makes it harder. And it turns out things are known about that, that we say, we're all creatures of habit. And it turns out that many instances, and it's easy if there was more time to give examples, but the way our brains are designed is to, once we've established that something is worth doing, often because we like what happens when we do it, once we do it a few times, our brains start to just automatically do it without much thought. And so it becomes almost like a newly learned reflex. So whenever, as Joanna knows too well, one example I use is that in this country, we all learn to look to the left before we cross the street. And it's, if you're aware of it, you notice how hard it would be. I'm advising you do it. You should always look to the left. But it's very hard not to look to the left. And one way you can prove to yourself that this is hardwired in is by going to London. Because you go to London, I go to London, which I've been a few times, it's very hard to remember to look to the right. Looking to the left will get you killed when you're crossing the street in London. And that's because our brains have this capacity to learn new behaviors that are worth learning and then file them so they're automatic. So we don't have to spend all our precious thinking time worrying about what direction I should look at when I cross the street. It's very efficient. It's a very clever way that the brain has been organized. But the problem is, if you learn a pattern of behavior that once upon a time made some sense, was rewarding, but maybe has ceased to be so rewarding, it may still be hard to get rid of because it's been so well learned in the first place. And we can come up with a line of thinking that suggests that perhaps this phenomenon of learned avoidance of foods, which may have been a very comforting thing to do when you were 15, once you've done it for 10 years, may have been engraved in your brain as sort of a well-learned pattern, a habit. And if that's so, it can be hard to change. We don't know this is true.
Right.
But
we found when we talk about it that patients find it it makes sense that there's this feeling that there's something habitual about pieces of the symptoms that they're experiencing. And what we're excited about as a study we've been doing for the last year, I would say, is we figured out with our cognitive neuroscience colleagues how to actually figure out whether the habit parts of the brain are involved when people are making decisions about food. And that's taken some work to really figure out how we can use modern tools like functional neuroimaging to help us answer key questions in anorexia nervosa. And this really feels like we have found a key question for patients that we can model in an MRI machine and really get at whether the parts of the brain that we think are involved in habit are the parts of the brain that are driving some of the choices patients make with eating disorders. And if we're right, then that opens a whole new line of treatment targets.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I don't want to overdo it because we also don't know whether it's right or not, which would be nice to know. But this is potentially, I don't want to overhype this.
Game changer.
Guy is going to say game changing. at least alters the game. I'm not sure it changes it, but it morphs it, it modifies it a bit. And it would help explain certain mysteries that we don't have good explanations for right now, like why is it the simple, why is it so hard to change? Why is it hard for people to learn to eat different ways, even when they want to? Why is it that drugs like Prozac, fluoxetine, which are very effective for sister disorders like bulimia, why don't they work so well at all for anorexia? And if the basis for anorexia nervosa is in a part of the brain that us psychiatrists usually don't think about targeting with our usual techniques, that would help explain why we need to learn new things and develop new techniques. It would change the way we do things.
Just for the sake of time, this is obviously a very rich topic, and we can talk about this.
We can talk about it all
day. We can
day.
Talk about this a long time, yeah.
And so I do want to thank you both for a great overview of research, but we just have a few questions from today's callers that I would just like to address. So it sounds like there are some new frontiers for research that you're talking about here. One of our callers is asking sort of the nature-nurture question. Mm. Is asking about, she has struggled with an eating disorder for many years and wondering now, she has a teenage daughter, and is wondering if this is something she needs to be particularly concerned about. And is this something that gets passed on genetically, or is it something, do we have answers to that, the nature-nurture question?
That's wrong.
We don't have good answers. We really don't. I think if you take a step back, which is easier for us to do than the parent, almost all human traits are passed along. To some degree. You know, height, eye color, all kinds of stuff tends to run in families. But it's a mistake to think it's controlled, it's definitive, it's inevitable. That is not the case. So I think the fact is that if a relative has an eating disorder, the odds of a kid having an eating disorder are higher than if a relative hadn't had an eating disorder, but not much. Most kids of parents who had an eating disorder will not have an eating disorder. So statistically, it goes up, the odds go up a little bit, but only a little. So yeah, I mean, families matter, genes matter, they matter in almost everything, but they aren't, in these illnesses, definitive. So I think mom should keep an eye out, as I'm sure she would anyway, but not fear that her daughter will inevitably develop an eating problem, because that is not true.
Okay, another question that's come in is perhaps related to what you began to address about learning about the brain, but someone asked about the difficulty in a relative who has an eating disorder having difficulty stopping those behaviors and the question of similarities to addiction. Mm-hmm. Is this something that we know about? Is this something we're looking into in the future? But what is, how can you address that question about relationship to addiction and eating behaviors?
It's certainly a question that people have a lot, because there are ways that people describe the experience and that I think are worth validating, that there are symptoms of these illnesses that are not willful. It's not that somebody could just stop if they wanted to, and why won't they just stop? There's clearly something biological going on, which is what we're trying to desperately to understand. But it's also clear that it's not the same thing as an addictive disorder, which has its own set of features and phenomena and probably slightly different treatment approaches, although there are similarities in that you're trying to change behavior and you're trying to help people shift out of a behavior that is no longer helpful to them, that's considered maladaptive. We've done some work trying to look at the similarities between eating disorders and addictive disorders. I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Well, the big point I would make is to echo what Joanna said, is there are parallels. I mean, there clearly are parallels. And, you know, we see patients who say, I'm addicted or I feel like I'm addicted. And indeed, you know, if you sort of look at the symptoms they describe and compare them to the symptoms that people who are addicted to hard drugs like cocaine describe, there are parallels. But what I think is it's a mistake, therefore, to conclude, since there's some similarities, that it's all the same. It's just an addiction. Because, and this may get too complicated, but we keep talking about how complicated the brain is. Well, yes and no. The brain's rewarding areas and the way it feels, the way we feel good, and the biology of what makes us feel good, that down in the weeds biology, is similar for all the things that make us feel good. You know, if we don't have an eating disorder, eating makes us feel good, and getting a good grade on an exam makes us feel good, and an attaboy from your coach makes you feel good. And these are probably all in different ways, but ending up in a final common pathway in the brain. So there are reward circuits in the brain, and they get connected to behavior. So it may not be so surprising that things that once made us feel good, that we've now been doing over and over again, and now find hard to change, feel like they're addicting. I think it's because the brain processes a lot of these kinds of things in the same way. So, I don't like the word addiction when it's applied to eating disorders, because I think it's more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people with anorexia nervosa are addicted to anything. They're just caught in this cycle of persistent dieting. I don't think people with bulimia are addicted to, you know, sweet, fat food. I think they have trouble. They can have real trouble stopping the consumption thereof, and it can feel like they're addicted to it. But I don't think it means they react to, you know, the sweet cake the way a cocaine addict reacts to cocaine. There's some parallels, but it ain't the same. It's a mistake, I think, to think that addictions are the eating disorders are problems of addiction. I think that's way oversimplified.
We have time just for one really quick final question, and that is: someone participates in research at your center. Do they still get treatment for their difficulty?
That's easy. Always. We don't. Once people agree to help us or to try to help us with our research, we promise to do our best to help them get better. And that's actually pretty sacred. I mean, I think that's
sure.
where we must do that. We cannot do otherwise.
Well, we've reached the end of our show today, so I'd like to thank Dr. Walsh and Dr. Steinglass for such an informative discussion. It seems like we've learned a lot over these years, but there's certainly a lot more to learn. So research is clearly still important in this field. I'd like to also thank our listeners for tuning in to Blog Talk Radio. For more information about treatment and research opportunities, please call 646-774-8066 or visit our website, columbiaeatingdisorders.org. We had a previously scheduled session on obesity that needed to get rescheduled. So for those of you who are interested in that talk, it will occur on Thursday, the 27th at 3 p.m. with Dr. Laurel Mayer and Robin Sisco. So we invite you to tune in. With that, have a good day.